New Centre at 6. As ministers announce a clampdown on so-called county lines drug gangs, critics say cuts to the Conservative Party has allowed the problem to grow. The Home Secretary has been on a raid by police in Liverpool and pledged more money to tackle criminal groups who exploit children as drug mules. Police investigating an attack on a woman in Sunderland are treating it as a hate crime. Charlie Graham, who's 20, says she suffered homophobic abuse during the assault last weekend by two men.
Got punched in the head, pushed to the floor. And then when I try to get up, they push the floor again, grazing my knees, my face, and cut my face open. I've been jumped on numerous occasions because of being gay, and I've had things shouted at us, and it is, in this day and age, it's disgusting.
Well, Charlie says it's the fifth time she's been attacked in Sunderland. Labour leadership hopeful Emily Thornberry is warning the party it faces a long, tough road back to power.
I want to be the woman, and I know I can be the woman who stands up and leads the fight back against Boris Johnson. And we're going to need to have somebody tough.
Kicking off her campaign in Guildford, the Shadow Foreign Secretary says she's been on the front line in fights against climate change and universal credit. The party suffered its worst election defeat since 1935 last month, and the fight is on to replace Jeremy Corbyn as leader. The US has announced yet more sanctions against Iran, calling them the toughest ever. Earlier, the country's supreme leader led Friday prayers for the first time in 8 years, calling Donald Trump a clown. The Royal Air Force says it regrets delays to dozens of planes trying to land at Heathrow earlier. The RAF requested the airspace was closed for about 20 minutes, something the airport says was unplanned. Researchers say cows can communicate their mood, including loneliness or excitement, through the noise they make. The University of Sydney has found they're talkative, social, and tell each other how they're feeling. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Welcome to the BCFM Politics Show. It's Friday, it's 6 o'clock. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is the Labour councillor for Ashley Ward, Mike Davies. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, James Jatras is one of the first analysts to popularise the term the deep state as distinct from Congress and the President. The kind of permanent government by banks and corporations and the revolving door into think tanks and big universities. Jim worked for 7 years at the US State Department through the 1990s and the collapse of the Soviet Union and into the early noughties. He has a warning for Boris Johnson. Keep a good relationship with Donald Trump, but resist Israeli influence. And above all, don't get into bed with the deep state. He says present tensions with Russia are far more dangerous than during the Cold War and explains exactly why that is. Also, Putin dissolves the government. He's 71 in 2024 and he's bringing in free education, free healthcare and all sorts of other social welfare benefits across Russia. That we haven't heard much about, have we, this week? And the Sons of David, the army seminary in Israel, Rabbi Giora Rada is just one who's recorded as teaching young Israelis soon to enter the military that Hitler was right about racism. We hear a Channel 13 investigative report from Israeli television with hidden cameras filming teachers, the rabbis, saying the Holocaust was not about killing Jews and that the real Holocaust is racial equality. And the Jewish Home Kahan Party, which is associated with the Sons of David Seminary, may soon be running Israel's education ministry in charge of educating all Israeli children, the Channel 13 Sting report says. Plus, forget Iran's uranium enrichment or Israel's 200 nuclear weapons for a minute. What about the half a ton of gold-encased enriched Nazi uranium which was heading for Japan in U-boat U-234 in May 1945? While the Manhattan Project was crying out for all the enriched uranium it could get. Well, after Hitler committed suicide, Admiral Dönitz was in charge of the dying Reich, and U-234 suddenly changed course to make rendezvous with a US destroyer. So who ordered the two Japanese officers on the sub to be shot on the night of the 12th of May. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 3 degrees Celsius tonight and dry. This weekend, highs around 7, mainly sunny. Next week, temperatures highs around 7 still, quite cold, but sunnier at the beginning of the week, cloudier towards the end of the week, and maybe warming up a little bit with the cloud. Next weekend, the 25th and 26th of January, highs around 9 Celsius, cloudy with light rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Labour councillor for Ashley, Mike Davis. Hi, Mike. Hello. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Now, I understand you're not standing as a Labour councillor in May. Why is that?
Oh, well, lots of reasons. I think a lot of younger councillors find it difficult to juggle the role with their other job, because you have to have another job, because council, being a councillor, doesn't pay a full-time wage. It only pays about 11,000 a year, less in some local authorities. I mean, I have really enjoyed the role. I really have really been, you know, I really love my ward and the communities and getting to know people. It's been a really, really rewarding job. But, you know, a lot of young people find it difficult to keep it going for a long time.
But, I mean, doesn't the Labour Party have a rule whereby they have to have a certain quantity of women standing and you're not a woman? Doesn't that have anything to do with it?
No, that had nothing to do with it.
Okay, that's good. Because I almost sense that you feel a little bit like you'd like to carry on, but you just can't. Maybe just financial reasons, is it?
I mean, it's lots of reasons. I couldn't possibly go into them all.
Because, I mean, the thing is, for example, another Labour councillor in Ashley, because I live in Ashley Ward, and another Labour councillor, Carol Johnson, over the last 4 years or so, I must have contacted her about 20 times, maybe 25 times on email, phone, all sorts of different ways. I haven't had a single response from her during all that time. And I just, you know, it seems a pity to me that somebody that doesn't respond to journalists or members of the public is carrying on as a councillor, whereas someone like yourself, who is prepared to step up to the plate when it comes to speaking to members of the public, speaking to journalists, isn't going to be around anymore. It just seems a pity to me.
I mean, nobody's guaranteed to be carrying on, because there's going to be an election in May, and, you know, people have a vote and they vote for who they want to be their councillors. So all 70 councillors we have could lose their seats, and you could have completely different people next time.
Well, what's your sense for how well Labour's going to do in the city? Because you had the Corbyn effect 5 years ago, and that surely was quite a positive thing. 4 or 5 years ago,
however long it was,
and now what we've got is Corbyn is now really a sort of tainted brand, having just massively lost the biggest loss of Labour since the 1920s, apparently. Do you think maybe the Corbyn effect is going to mean that another party starts to be resurgent?
Well, I'll make 3 points. Firstly, you know, we just had an election, a general election, and in Bristol, all four Labour MPs kept their seats with healthy majorities. Their vote share was relatively healthy.
But this is a local election. It's likely to be much more. People are much more volatile when it comes to local elections, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
And, of course,
yeah,
with the mayoral election too, it's done under a different system. It's not the first past the post.
By the time it's the election in May, we'll have a new Labour leader in April, so that could have an effect. I mean, it could be a leader that people in Bristol really like. Also, you know, we had a by-election yesterday in Brislington, and the Labour vote share was relatively unchanged since 2016, and we actually increased our majority in that seat. So, I think Labour will do fairly well in May.
Okay, so in the general election, before we start talking about looking forward and looking at the leadership candidates for the Labour Party, the main opposition party in Britain, just about still, and let's have a listen to a bit of a deconstruction of why Labour lost back in December from one of the great stalwarts of the Labour Party, a chap called Lord Mandelson, who, I have to remember back in the Blair years, was kicked out, I believe, twice out of office for various sorts of corruption. But he's still a major figure in the Labour Party, although lots of people in the Labour Party are being removed from the party or suspended from the party for making comments about Israel, for example, in the present era. People like Mandelson and Blair are still very happy. Do you want to just say something about that, Martin? It's a bit of a contrast, isn't it? So you've got activists criticising Israel quite often are suspended from the party, yet at the same time you've got someone like Lord Mandelson or Tony Blair still happily members of the Labour Party.
Well, I think there is an issue there, especially in relation to Tony Blair, but the fact is that the party is and always has been a very broad church, and you can't necessarily expel people just because you don't agree with them.
Well, it's not a very broad church when it comes to people making comments about Israel, is it?
Oh, no, I think that's another issue. Clearly, you know, the establishment side of the Labour Party gets away with a lot of things that the more radical wing doesn't get away with, but that's normal. That's the way the world works, isn't it?
It looks as if the party is about to cede control of decisions made about whether people are or are not anti-Semitic to groups outside the party, which will be very interesting to see how that goes. But anyway, let's have a listen to hear what Lord Mandelson has to say, who's very much a sort of Blairite right-wing member of the Labour Party, about why the party lost the general election in December, and maybe we can hear from you two about to what extent you agree with his analysis.
First of all, let me say I'm pretty devastated by what happened. I'm shocked by it, not entirely surprised, because I'm afraid I don't think the result was entirely undeserved by the Labour Party. If you go in to an election with a leader who is sort of minus 40% in his own ratings, a programme which was, let's face it, so extreme. I mean, not in many of the ideas and individual policies it put forward, but collectively, the sheer impracticality and unaffordability and poorly costed nature of a programme like that is bound to be rejected by very many voters, and that's exactly what's happened. But I'm not just devastated, in a sense, by the loss of some brilliant Labour MPs and candidates and the loss that many communities must be feeling about the absence now of a Labour government and the huge expectations that they had from a Labour government. But I'm shocked, in a sense, by the sheer indifference shown by the present leadership of the Labour Party, the Momentum organisation, whose spokesmen and women I've been listening to on radio and television. It's a sort of shrug. It's a sort of, well, you know, swings and roundabouts. At least we're pure to ourselves. As long as we can keep hold of what we believe in and what we want to think is right, then I'm afraid it doesn't matter, because we don't want to compromise with the electorate. That's the sort of attitude I've been hearing, and I'm just simply appalled by it.
Do you think it was Brexit that caused the defeat?
No.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Mandelson, of course, had the opportunity to bring in proportional representation when Labour had 13 years in government, and they bottled it. They talked about it, and they talked about building a different kind of politics, and then when it came down to it, they just wanted the same old machine politics. And, of course, what's happened in Scotland since then basically means that the political system, as he is talking about it, is finished. And he's not really recognising that. And, of course, he was very strongly in favour of Remain, in favour of a second referendum,
He's saying that the Labour Party, as you see it, is finished, actually.
I think some of the criticisms of Momentum are to the point, because what they've done is they've just presumed that they just capture the Labour machine and then Labour just comes to power and then they can do what they want. There was always going to be a problem with that. You've got to form alliances with other people than just the left of the Labour Party.
But he's absolutely spot on to condemn the leadership, who completely failed. Completely failed to run a credible campaign.
Well, listen, the manifesto and all the stuff about its own costs and all the rest, they talk about the longest suicide note in history, about 1983. Now, people don't read manifestos, but the main point of the 1983 manifesto was nationalise the banks get rid of Trident, and so on. It all seems terribly extreme. But in fact, see, 20 years later, you think actually we should have done all those things. Ultimately, it's very difficult to get a radical program through in a society like this, which is run by very conservative oligarchy that control the media. And I'm not saying that to make excuses.
All you're doing is saying it to blame the press.
No, I think
what the actual fault was with the policies.
Well, it's also the case that people like Mandelson and many others who claim that they basically were sabotaged in many respects the Labour Party. I mean, we've had people were basically Labour upstanding people basically sabotaging the leadership from the get-go. Two attempts to remove Corbyn, pointless, didn't achieve anything. And of course Jeremy Corbyn should have committed to PR. I tried to get him to commit to PR when he was first came to Bristol years ago.
Mike,
and of course that's what he should have done and he didn't do.
Mike, what about Mandelson saying things, I mean there was a lot in there, but he's saying that what he's condemning is the leadership, basically saying that we don't want to compromise with the electorate. In other words, that means we're not listening to the electorate.
Well, I stood as a parliamentary candidate in the Bath constituency, and I stood on that manifesto, and I was very proud to stand on that manifesto, and I really believed in all the policies we were offering.
But you've got a problem, haven't you? Because the voters didn't. It's okay for people like you and to candidates to believe in a manifesto, but that manifesto has got to be tailor-made. You know, it's actually a fairly humble thing to do. You've got to really look at what the voters want, and you've got to tailor-make that manifesto to them.
Well, I think that we suffered a serious defeat, and we have to have humility, and we have to be willing to change and do what we need to do to win again, because that's the point of the Labour Party. It was founded to win power and achieve socialism through parliamentary means. So, we shouldn't think that the voters were wrong, you know, even if they did what we didn't want them to do. We need to understand, you know, the message they're sending us.
And one of those messages is definitely to do with Brexit. Let's go back and have a listen, whatever it is, 30, 40 years ago, to a former leader of the Labour Party. That's Michael Foote, and what he had to say about Brexit. It's maybe interesting to see the contrast between the modern day attitude in the Labour Party to Brexit and what people like Michael Foote had to say.
People didn't fight for the vote just to have the fun of electioneering. They wanted to see that the vote that they used at the ballot box could change things, stop things, alter things, remove governments when necessary. That's one of the principal reasons for having a vote. But that's not going to happen if we're going to stay in the market and if we become enmeshed in the whole of their machinery and apparatus. Because what will happen then is that you can go and have an election in this country in which you vote out the government here, but you won't be voting out all the governments that meet in Brussels to decide what's going to happen to us. It is that precious inheritance given us by the people who fought for the right to vote, fought for the right to form trade unions, fought for the right to establish their own institutions, fought for the right to have an elected House of Commons, which should be the supreme authority in this country and answerable to nobody else. It is those things that are at stake in this campaign. We will have plenty of problems to solve after June the 5th, but let us make it clear that not merely to our own country, but to the other countries, that we believe here in Britain we can solve these problems by using the strength of our democratic institutions instead of casting them aside in this trivial, wanton way. We were led into it by Heath and his companions, a more defeatist, miserable lot has never exercised power in British history. We were led into them by a mood of defeatism. And people say, oh, now we're so caught and trembling inside that we can do nothing about it. I say that is defeatism too. What we have to do is to reassert the power, the spirit and the determination of British democracy. That's what this campaign is about.
Well, that was the Labour leader, Michael Foote, 44 years ago, very, very long time. I think I was rather small. I don't know if you've even been thought of, Mike, at that time, but a long, long time ago. But, you know, he's making some quite important points there. He's saying, well, look, hang on a minute, you know, what's the point of voting in the UK election if actually someone at Brussels is making decisions? And that attitude seems to be almost lost from Labour. There are one or two MPs that are speaking like that, but very few. And I just wonder whether you think that it was Brexit or it was the personality of Corbyn or what it was that was the main reason that Labour, you know, was heading off in the wrong direction and not, not tuning in, not connecting up with the voters.
I mean, I don't have the answer to why Labour lost the election. I don't think it was one particular cause. I think there are lots of causes, even, you know, beyond Brexit, although, you know, that was an issue, beyond Jeremy Corbyn, although, you know, that was an issue with some voters. I think that the causes of this defeat actually go back quite a long way in terms of how the Labour Party has become more sort of culturally progressive, cosmopolitan, Remain supporting, and that, you know, there's been a divide between Labour members, Labour politicians, and, you know, the traditional working class who largely voted Leave.
Because the thing is, the way you analyse what went wrong is going to determine for a lot of Labour members which way they vote and which leader they vote for. So before we hear about that from Martin, I just thought it would be nice to go back and hear what some of the commitments to Brexit were made by Labour MPs and senior Labour politicians and others in the wake of the referendum in 2016, the Brexit referendum. So let's have a listen to that now. And this is a compilation which was put up online by a group called Change Britain.
You, the British people, will decide.
This is a once-in-a-generation vote.
This is the once-in-a-lifetime decision.
This is a decision, a once-and-for-all decision. We will not be taking a decision like this again in our lifetime.
There won't be another referendum on Europe. This is it.
This is a one-off choice between staying in or leaving completely.
If we as a country decide to quit, then we're out for good. There's no going back.
There's no second vote.
There will be no second referendum.
No, I don't think we need a second referendum.
The referendum is clear and has to be accepted, and we can't have a rerun of the question that was put to the country.
I say that with all the conviction and all the sincerity I have. It's so important, this decision.
If we vote to leave, then we will leave.
If people vote to leave, we leave.
You vote to leave, we're out. That's it. We're going.
Whatever the result is, we have to respect it.
We respect the result of this referendum.
And Parliament should respect that referendum result. We've said that all the way through.
Whatever the British people decide, we work together constructively to make that happen.
I don't think it would be right for Parliament to try and unravel the decision that the public have made.
The British Parliament should deliver what is required of that decision of the British people.
I am not going to waste time, precious time, resisting Brexit from happening.
We'd be out of the single market.
We're leaving the single market.
Right.
We're leaving the customs union.
In March 2019, we will cease to be full members of the single market and the customs union.
You have 2 years to negotiate. At the end of those 2 years, you are out and you have to operate under World Trade Organization rules.
No deal will be better than a bad deal.
Yes, you said that repeatedly.
Yes.
And it will be the final decision.
And if anybody's in any doubt, we are going to leave the European Union on the 29th of March 2019.
So that's a compilation by Change Britain of a whole load of politicians from all spectrums, including Jeremy Corbyn, I heard in there, John McDonnell, I think one of them was Richard Burgeon, the Labour Party. Everybody basically saying this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And then what happened was the Labour Party rode back on that, Martin, didn't they? And actually didn't really want an election in the first place. Anyway, so what's your, in a nutshell, review of exactly why the Labour Party lost?
Well, I think it's odd, isn't it? You've got people like Mandelson saying Jeremy Corbyn didn't go down well, and basically Mandelson was in favour of a second referendum. As mainstream liberal opinion in the Liberal Democrat Party, the Nationalist parties, other progressive forces were quite clear that there would have probably be a second. There's going to be no second referendum now. We're going to have a no-deal Brexit at this time next year, which is going to basically, for example, crash our car industry. And that people voted for that, and that's what they're going to get. But whether they're going to like it, Tony, is another matter. And, of course, if you look at the actual cephalogy
of December
the 12th...
What was the reason, Martin? What I asked you was, what do you think the main reason was Labour lost?
Well, in the northern constituencies, where the rot is, it's quite clear that they wanted Brexit. So the right wing of the party saying, what we've got to do is ask for a second referendum, they're responsible for losing those votes. Jeremy Corbyn tried to triangulate between the two factions within the party, but he found it very difficult. See, Corbyn probably, within the shadow cabinet, was probably the least Euro-friendly of all of them. And he basically didn't want a second referendum, and he quietly resisted it. So they wanted him to have a second referendum, but if he said he wanted a second referendum, they'd then say, oh, well, we've got all these Leave voting. And I don't agree that all working class people voted Leave. It's actually, I'm from Merseyside, and Merseyside people voted pretty solidly for Remain. But, you know, I'm Lancs, not Yorks, you know. And it's actually the big cities, is pretty clear. And
if you were speaking
when people say there's going to be one, when Cameron and all these other people say we're going to have one vote and that's the end of it.
What's your analysis?
They can say what they like. I didn't promise anything.
What needs to change in the Labour leadership to actually put someone in place who can get rid of Boris at the next general election?
What we need to do is commit to proportional representation. We should have committed to do it 20 years ago.
The public, the last time the public were asked about that, they said no thanks.
That's right, but except in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, we've already got it. So whatever happens, the cat's out of the bag. And it's quite possible, for example, after 5 years, the Scots won't be in the next UK general election. So there's no point worrying about winning Scotland.
Well, Boris has said that ain't going
to
happen.
Yeah, but I mean, don't forget that Gorbachev said the same thing to the Lithuanians, and Belgrade said the same thing to the Slovenians. Yeah? In actual fact, that's not the way these things work.
Did Madrid say that to the Catalonians?
Yes, that's right, and the crisis goes on. Doesn't it? Because the people in Catalonia didn't quite have enough votes. But if they got enough votes, they can declare independence, whether other people recognise it or not.
Before we get on to looking at these specific candidates, I was just looking this week as half of households are facing homelessness in one of the towns up north. A council report says young people lack skills to manage tenancies. So half of households facing homelessness have jobs. So we're saying, really, the message here, Mike, is that getting a job isn't a route out of poverty anymore. And it might be that you get a job, but you can't actually earn enough to put down a deposit, get somewhere to live. So half of households in this particular town, Knowsley, have got jobs. They're homeless ones. Also, in Insecure Britain, this is a great little article on the London Economic. Fascinating analysis, I thought. Anyway, Insecure Britain, we are 2.5 paychecks away from homelessness on average. So we've got, the people that the Labour Party would like to appeal to are finding that they just have hardly got enough money coming in to pay the rent. And if, for whatever reason, they lose their job, as many people do, that's it. They're going to be out within two paychecks. They're going to be out on the street.
Well, I think that these kind of issues you're talking about should make the Labour Party really reflect on the fact that a lot of working class people who have really suffered under austerity for the past decade actually voted Conservative, and we have to ask why they did that and why what we were offering wasn't appealing to them despite all the issues they've got. I don't think we should just say that voters are sort of brainwashed by the media and so on, because that's quite patronising. I think if people voted Boris Johnson, then there was something about or lots of things about voting for that appealed to them.
I'd suggest it's mostly to do with Brexit. Anyway, knife crime offences in England and Wales are a 10-year high, as the Prime Minister calls for action, even though, of course, it may well be his Conservative government over the last 10 years that's caused that situation to be. There are 22,286 knife and weapon offences formally dealt with by the police and courts in England and Wales last year, a 3% rise on the previous year. Martin, it's not really looking good, is it? I mean, is it fair to say that maybe austerity has got something to do with this?
Well, it's clearly got something to do with it, but I mean, these kind of social issues are very complex, And, you know, they run for years. I mean, look at the gun crime in the United States of America. It's been there forever.
I mean, is it related? Do you think it's fair to say it's related to gang culture?
Well, of course it's related to gang culture.
And organised crime?
It's related to the illegality of drugs and all the rest of it, because that creates lawlessness, because you've got a huge illegal market which people are operating.
Well, let me just remind you, because back in 2014, there was a fascinating change in the way that Britain looks at its accounts. This was done by George Osborne. In April 2014, at the beginning of the financial year, he decided he was going to include prostitution and illegal drugs in the national economic figures, so to basically boost gross domestic product by, would either of you like to guess how much adding those into the official GDP figures actually increased GDP, Martin and Mike?
I don't know.
I would guess around 10%, something like that.
Well, in billion, in terms of billion.
Oh, no, I can't guess it in terms
okay,
of billion.
Okay, so the estimates are, okay, so the figures in 2014 looked really good for the British economy, because £12.27 billion had been added to the UK economy because prostitution and drug dealing were added into the figures. Now, of course, it does make you wonder whether the incentive to stop the peddling of drugs and of prostitution, Mike, has been sort of encouraged really by George Osborne by doing that, and that potentially this is one of the things that's encouraged this gang culture. Now, maybe I'm, you know, stretching a point there, but I wonder if you think maybe some connection between the official Treasury figures now including prostitution and drugs and adding that in to the GDP have made a difference.
Well, I'm the councillor for St. Paul's. You know, we have issues with knife crime and related issues, so obviously I'm aware of some of the factors involved. You know, we've had austerity, and local authorities have borne the biggest brunt of austerity, including youth service provision, which has really suffered in my ward and in lots of places around the country, and I think that has an impact.
Just looking at the figures there, I think we're looking now, because there's been a whole programme of reducing the money going to local authorities from central government, we're now looking at something like 30% of the money coming from central government to Bristol City Council that there was in 2010. I mean, that's an enormous reduction
in
what the local authority can only actually do, a third of what it used to do back in 2010.
Yeah, and it's completely unsustainable. The government is going to have to fund local authorities more, like they're going to have to fund all public services more.
Martin, will they?
I think what's happened is there's been a turning point. The Tories have now decided that balancing the books is old hat, and now we're going to do Brexit, that in actual fact there's plenty of money. There's not one magic money tree, there's a whole forest of magic money trees, and that is actually a victory. And of course we've also pushed them to say they're not going to put the NHS up for sale to the Americans. And of course, when coming back to Michael Foot earlier, going on about Brussels telling us what to do, we don't control the government of the United States of America either, do we? We don't have any votes there. But they tell us what to do. When they assassinated Soleimani the other week, they didn't bother to tell Boris Johnson, did they? We've got the Irish Guards in Iraq now basically doing force protection. They can't leave their base.
But you can't blame them for putting up the figures of GDP and adding in prostitution.
No.
That's a British decision. Osborne.
All right. But I'm just pointing out that you can't control the situation in the way, you know, I'm just picking up on a previous point. The fact of the matter is that the drugs industry is massively enabled by the City of London. That's where all the money goes. And if everybody knows this, yeah? The world knows this.
But isn't it sort of creating a bit of a mob culture to say, well, actually, it's okay, prostitution, drugs, that's all fine?
No. What's got to happen is you've got to face reality, like in Colombia and other places. And Mexico, Lopez Obrador is talking in terms of we're going to have to legalise drugs. We've lost 60,000 people in the last 2 years. We can't go on like this. And, of course, what you've got is this illegalist approach to drugs, which has been pushed by the US, our real masters. And, of course, the Iran-Contra affair made it absolutely clear that the CIA have been in top-level drug dealing for years and years and years. That's what they do. They fund Auto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, the right-wing paramilitaries, with drug dealing. The CIA, Pablo Escobar's son said, everybody knows that my father worked with the CIA.
So should Pablo Escobar just be integrated into the Mexican
government? No.
Should he just be integrated into the Mexican government?
Well, no.
I mean, that's effectively what you seem to be suggesting, George.
No, that's already the case, Tony. That's already the case. In actual fact, the right wing across Latin America, in Bolivia, for example, the people in power now are the same people who were in power in the 1980s. The Hugo Banzer and the generals. And they're all in the drugs trade up to their eyeballs along with their American allies. And the reason the CIA wants drugs illegal is because it gives them a huge slush fund to throw around to get their allies.
Anyway, it'd be interesting to hear from Mike who you reckon. I mean, Keir Starmer is still the front runner for Labour leader, because obviously somebody needs to deal with and needs to be a credible figure to take Boris on. Keir Starmer, though, according to one article in The Independent, is a bad choice for Labour. It's just too easy for Boris Johnson to destroy his reputation, he says. As Boris, as Director of Public Prosecutions, Keir Starmer refused to prosecute the police officers who killed John Charles de Menezes and Ian Tomlinson. So it's two innocent members of the public killed by, or some might say executed by, police officers. He said, oh no, we're not going to prosecute them. He said it wouldn't take much for a handful of cases to turn Starmer into textbook establishment stooge in the eyes of both right and left. So in 2009-10, Starmer refused to prosecute the police officers who killed Jean Charles de Menezes. He was a Brazilian on a tube train in London. It was just after the London bombings. Martin, doesn't look good for Starmer, does it? Something like that. If he's just saying, well, actually, I'll tell you what, they just say these police are above the law. They don't need to go to court.
You asking me? Yeah, well, I'd just say, in actual fact, the great British public sadly don't really care about things like that, and that's a bit of liberal whinging in The Independent. They ought to care about it, but they don't. Starmer, in fact, the problem with Starmer, from my point of view, is a bit too establishment. And if he wants my vote, and he may get it, I'm certainly considering voting for him, he's got to actually show some radical radical grit.
Mike, in 2012, Keir Starmer announced that MI5 and MI6 agents will not face charges of torture and extraordinary rendition during the Iraq War. I mean, this is one of the reasons that this guy's written this article. He's saying, well, actually, some of these cases may come back to haunt Starmer as somebody who's supposed to be in charge, really, of the government version of the rule of law, you know, the Crown Prosecution Service. He's basically let officials get off scot-free for all sorts of horrific crimes, including executing people and torturing people.
I mean, I don't think the public are going to be that interested in his entire record in his career. I mean, you know, I know in the election we combed through everything Boris Johnson had written and everything he'd said, and we pulled up all these things about all these bigoted things he'd said, and the public didn't really care. I mean, so I don't think it's that relevant.
Okay,
I don't think the Tories are going to be able to attack him on those grounds. They were gung-ho all the way.
No, but other candidates might, and we had an interesting incident with Jess Phillips, another one of the candidates, just under a week ago. She suspended one of her key aides for posting offensive anti-Semitic and anti-Israel tweets with inverted commas over offensive. I mean, that Daily Mail here is saying that, you know, basically stating that the tweets were anti-Semitic, although I'll put a link up to it on our show page, this article. If you read through them, really what she's doing is she's just criticising Israel. She's comparing Israel, for example, to the Islamic State. She says that the Jewish faith is based on love, and she's criticising the Israeli state for not really going along with that. So, Martin, this is Jess Phillips, and she's just suspended this woman in the party for saying these things, which essentially are just criticising Israel.
Yeah, and Jess Phillips will make her own decisions about that, and we'll make our judgments about her. One of the things that is worrying, Rebecca Long Bailey and everybody have signed up to this British Board of Deputies Jews 10-point thing, which, and as you pointed out earlier, it's going to mean that a non-party person is going to be brought in to carry out disciplinary business inside the Labour Party. Now, I'm afraid we're going to have this row.
Well, they say it's an independent body, because the Labour Party can't be trusted make decisions about anti-Semitism.
The Board of Deputies of British Jews and the chief rabbi, for example, who was criticising Corbyn, he's a lifelong Tory voter and a personal friend of Boris Johnson. Now, why should we put somebody like that in charge of internal procedures in our party, which we pay for? I just don't accept that.
Mike?
I mean, I understood why the candidates agreed to the The pledges of the Board of Deputies. I know some of Rebecca Long Bailey's supporters were disappointed that she agreed to them. But I think from her perspective, you know, if she didn't agree, it would create a huge row. And, you know, candidates don't want to attract negative publicity to their campaigns.
Well, interestingly, of all the candidates, only one, Rebecca Long Bailey, has led the charge amongst Labour's leadership hopefuls yesterday as the first to commit to a 10-point pledge on tackling Islamophobia as well. The measures compiled by the Muslim Council of Britain and backed by Labour Muslim Network include adopting the All-Parliamentary Group on British Muslims' definition of Islamophobia as being rooted in racism and a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness and perceived Muslimness. Ms. Long Bailey said that she will not just support the pledges but will stand with the Muslim community if she succeeds Jeremy Corbyn as leader. So at least there is some sort of something on the other side as well from Rebecca Long Bailey.
Well, I think I welcome that, obviously, but I'm still not happy. I think a lot of we're going to have a discussion about international politics and the role of Israel. I was an aid worker in the 1990s in Bosnia, and I actually supported the intervention in Bosnia and in Kosovo. But of course, who didn't support that was the Israeli right-wing government, because they understood immediately what the implications of that were. If we're going to go to war with Serbia and kill 10,000 civilians so that they can't have Slovenia, they can't have Kosovo, they can't have Bosnia, why should we put up with the Israelis doing exactly that?
Are we in danger of having a kind of Zionist UK Labour Party?
Well, this is one of the problems, because there's a very, very strong Zionist lobby in this country. The Al Jazeera sting on these ex-members of the Labour Party.
Well, we know in the States it's very, very strong. Well, here, not so strong.
Oh, it is. It's behind the scenes. It's very strong. And that's why everybody's terrified of saying things in case it offends some people. But I'm afraid freedom of speech is freedom of speech inside or outside the Labour Party. And of course, it's going to come to a head, because we're possibly going to go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis and the Americans happy. And then we'll see who stands up to be counted, won't we?
Well, okay, let's look at looking at Martin,
the Jews. We'll see what they've got to say about it.
We're looking at the odds. The odds are Keir Starmer number one at 5-11. Rebecca Long Bailey. I should do this every week, really. Rebecca Long Bailey is second at 3-1, Lisa Nandy third at 10-1, and Jess Phillips at 50-1, a long way behind. Who do you think's going to win, Mike?
Oh, I couldn't. All to play for. We're still at an early stage. You know, we haven't even had the first hustings yet, which is tomorrow, actually.
We haven't had the first smear campaign and the first scandal, have we?
Well, also, you have a second preference. You have a third preference, a fourth preference. So, a preferential voting system, someone could win even if they don't win on the first round as well.
Okay, Martin, who do you think is going to win?
I think, looking at it, it's probably going to be Keir Starmer, provided he is able to convince the Labour grassroots, who are the basic voters.
You're going
to
hate me for saying this, but Keir Starmer, the establishment choice.
No, that's one way of looking at it, but if he wants to get the votes of the Labour Party activists, he's got to show that he's more than just a suit, frankly. And Rebecca Long Bailey, to my mind, has missed the plot, because she's not spoken about proportional representation, which I keep banging on about. And people say, oh, it's just because we lost this election. I've been on this show for 10 years, Tony. Every week I've said we need to change the system. We're the only European country that has first past the post. The only one. There wouldn't be a Tory government in this country. There never would have been one if this was Denmark, Ireland, or any of the other European countries. And the only other country in the world that actually has first past the post is the United States of America, where Donald Trump got 3 million votes less than Hillary Clinton, but he's the president nevertheless. It's
okay,
rubbish.
Tons of rubbish now sent to Europe will soon be burned in Avonmouth. Another one of the big incinerators up in Gloucestershire, just on the side of the M5, Mike, has just opened. We're burning a lot of our rubbish now, and of course amongst some of that rubbish may be little bits of plastic. Anyway, there's a lot of environmentalists think that this is an absolute disaster. It's better actually to bury it in the ground rather than burn it. And I had a chat to he's a old friend of mine, Charlie Holmes. He used to run a recording studio. He now lives in Tuscany in Italy. And he's been battling for many years with the I think it's Milan, authorities over waste incinerators over there. And he's found that the mafia are very, very much involved in the whole waste business over in Italy. And he fears that perhaps we should be worried about such a thing here in Bristol. Anyway, I had a chat to him about what he makes of the whole explosion that we're seeing now in the idea of burning rather than burying much of our waste.
I'm Charlie Arms. I live in Tuscany. I've been living here 30 years or more. And, yeah, I became involved in the environmental activities. We got an incinerator down the road. The problem with incineration is that you create nanoparticles. They are something like 0.0006, I think, this once it gets to that. You don't have to breathe that in. That goes straight into your skin. And the only way to create these particles is through incineration or ballistics. And that's where you get your depleted uranium. Yeah, they put that in the shells, and then when the shell explodes, that becomes nanoparticles. So, in actual fact, it's a chemical weapon. The Italian mafia, they're very useful to the government because like they've got this big problem, a huge problem. And the mafia are very helpful in getting rid of it. I mean, apart from the fact they bury it, they do a lot of scams with it. I think the figures are like 200 ships have set sail from Italian ports into the Mediterranean and sunk full of toxic waste. Google it. Italian mafia sink ship is about 200 or something like that. They have just gone down full of toxic waste in the Mediterranean. So, yeah, the mafia make rubbish disappear, which is very handy for the local authorities. Then you've got these multinationals like Suez coming into it, and there are quite a few of those. And they're set up. So, I mean, the when this local authority does what I call the pact with the devil, which is also a conflict of interest because the local authority should protect its citizens from the likes of incinerators, basically. And they're obviously not going to send their inspectors to the incinerator every week to check what's going on, because if they block the incinerator, then they've got piles of rubbish building up on the streets, and that's the last thing they want, because that's obviously going to be used by their political opponents as a big hammer against them. So they've got to keep that incinerator running. And also, the people like Suez are not there to provide a service to the public. They're there to make money. So if they can save money, which by what they do in Italy is, they take out the filters. They don't have them running. And when they've got the inspectors come around, they obviously put them back in again. So they save a lot of money because, as I said to you before, one of the questions to ask these people about their wonderful technology is, what do you do with the filters? How do you clean the filters? I mean, they're full. If they hold all these nanoparticles, then they're full of nanoparticles. The people who are against incinerators say they don't hold the nanoparticles. It's not possible to stop these nanoparticles. But either way, they're pretty terrible, these filters. And what do they do with them? How do they clean that? I mean, in Italy, there are instances where it's been claimed, and probably true, is that throw the filters into the incinerator. So they burn them, basically.
Well, that's Charlie Holmes, a long-time campaigner against incinerators over in Italy, worried to see Bristol going down the same route. And probably the best article about this is in the December edition of the Bristol Cable by Lorna Stevenson. The article, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Burning waste, the green energy or just hot air. And she makes a lot of the points that Charlie is not really talking about, the idea that they might not have any filters in there, because of course it's at the top of a chimney, and who would climb up there to find out if a filter is even in the chimney. But also she doesn't suggest that the company running it, Viridor, I think, is going to be taking the filters out of there and just burning them in the bottom of the filter once the inspectors have gone away. Anyway, so there's a lot of money to be made out of waste. And I think most important point Charlie's making there is that the local authority, Mike, may have a conflict of interest in that they want the waste to be disposed of, and so they don't really want to be finding fault with these incinerator companies who, if they do find fault with them, the whole incinerator might have to shut down.
Well, I think that our council is committed to, you know, good environmental standards, and we try to express that in our planning policies and our planning enforcement policies.
Well, the trouble with the incinerators in Avonmouth, of course, is they're right upwind from the city, so anything you know, belching out of the top of these things, wonderfully clean and super. I mean, what maybe best thing to do would be to maybe make the manager's office of the incinerator at the top of the chimney, so that if he's prepared to breathe the air that's coming out of the top of that chimney, or she, then maybe we can have a bit more confidence that it's not a whole load of nanoparticles and toxic waste heading straight for the city that we're then breathing in. And it all seems a little bit, hypocritical that we've got a anti-diesel policy. We're just about to ban diesel cars from the city centre whilst there's all this muck potentially coming out the top of incinerators. Anyway, Martin, the profit motive here, of course, is obvious. Anyone who's got a licence to run one of these incinerators is just simply there to make money. They're not necessarily going to be doing everything they can to keep the air clean that's heading for Bristol.
Well, I mean, that's a basic point about the public sector as opposed to the private sector. So, of course, as a socialist, I'd rather this was all run by the local authority. But I'd point out that our good friend who's now deceased, Julian Parry, from Western Supermare, as you know, he developed a mechanism for burning waste, but within sealed containers so that nothing escapes. And it was a whole new technology which he pioneered. And remember, he was going around the world trying to sell this. And of course, the existing waste, he's saying a lot of recycling, frankly, it doesn't work. And
they try and talk about this as recycling. One of the things Lorna's put in this article, excellent article, I think everyone should have a good look at this, because it looks like so much environmental hypocrisy here. It says the 42 incinerators in the UK in 2015 emitted a total of nearly 11 million tonnes of CO2, 5 million tonnes from fossil fuel sources such as burning plastic. Now, I think even kids know you don't burn plastic, because really nasty toxic stuff will come out, and also this is adding to the whole climate crisis.
Ultimately, what you need to do is you need to pass laws to make sure that packaging is sustainable. Yeah, you just returnable bottles, paper bags, all of this sort of stuff. I mean, we've scratched the surface by charging people for plastic bags. You just charge them 5p and the use of plastic bags massively goes down. It's quite straightforward, really. And, of course, you've got to have an overall plan for what you want to do. And what Julian Parry was arguing a long time ago was that you can burn waste, but you've got to put it in sealed containers so that nothing escapes. And that's perfectly feasible if you want to do it. But, of course, you've got vested interests in recycling as it is now. This kind of burning, the waste industry, like most capitalist industries, is run on a short-term profit basis. It's not run on any kind of long-term plan of any kind. And what we ultimately need, if we're going to save the planet and all the rest of it, is we're going to need a long-term plan to sort all this out, tackling it from every angle.
Okay, so another policy which has come in with the new Conservative government is this anti-traveller policy. We're just having a whole load of new laws being brought in to criminalise living. Well, they call it unauthorised encampments, but of course, for many people, that's just where they live. And so, effectively, they're being criminalised just for being. Never mind. They've obviously got to be somewhere, and this is almost like a throwback to maybe the 18th and 19th century, where we used to have criminal trespass. That's what they're bringing in. It's a superb article by George Monbiot in The Guardian, I think it was last week, looking at this whole idea of making trespass criminal. So if you walk onto a piece of land that's not yours, all the landowner has to do is not come over to you and politely say, do you mind going back? But they just call the police.
Well, I haven't looked into that particular policy in detail, but I do think that government policy needs to be respectful of all racial and cultural groups we have.
But the thing is also, I mean, gypsies and travellers are supposed to be protected by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at an international level, at the European human rights law, British human rights law, and yet this is targeting a whole traditional community, which, hang on a minute, folks, has been there since the dawn of time. And we're now saying, well, we're not going to allow them to be anymore. And we had a few weeks ago, before Christmas, we had Ree Bisso and some other people from the Bristol Traveller community on here saying, well, look, we've been, many of us have been told, well, we can't squat, and that's criminal. And now we're being told that just simply by being on a piece of wasteland, now that's going to be criminalised too. And the fascinating thing about this, Martin, is that the police have also said, we think this is a ridiculous idea.
Well, if we're going to have a more Americanised society, you've got to recognise that the United States of America has been absolutely normal for many, many years for people to live in tent cities and sleep
in their cars. And also,
funnily
enough,
that's what modern capitalism
looks
like.
In the US, since the 1960s, there's also been criminal trespass laws as well. So you can get
the police. You can pass all the laws you like, but if you have a crash and everybody loses their house, as we were talking earlier about people two paychecks away from being homeless, they end up sleeping in their cars or, alternatively, living in tent cities. And if you go to the United States of America, you will find in the big cities people living in sewers because there's nowhere else for them to go. And there's no social housing.
That's interesting, isn't it?
It's because a private sector for everything.
In the modern world, migrant labour has taken over a lot of the things like fruit picking jobs that gypsies and travellers used to do more traditionally. And the whole business of migrant labour came up in the House of Commons at Prime Minister's Questions this week with Boris Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The seasonal agricultural worker scheme affords a limit of 10,000 temporary visas for agricultural workers from abroad to come and work in the UK in support of food production. Given that my constituency of Angus requires 4,000 alone and neighbouring constituencies a similar amount, isn't it clear, and will the Prime Minister concede, that 10,000 isn't enough even for Tayside, much less Scotland or the rest of the UK? Will he therefore instruct his friend the Home Secretary to take a review of this and, in support of the National Farmers Union of Scotland and our whole agricultural sector, commission that review to look upwards to a limit that will support the actual operational requirements of agriculture in our country?
I think that the Honourable Gentleman raises a very important point, and we have doubled the scheme, and we will make sure that Scottish agricultural sector, the agricultural sector of the entire country, does have access to the seasonal work and the workforce that it needs. And I understand very, very well the point that he makes, and that is why we're introducing a points-based immigration system that will enable this country to get the skills that it needs.
Well, I mean, it has the skills that it needs for a lot of these itinerant workers. It's just saying that they're not allowed anymore, Martin, these people who are basically just living in vehicles. I mean, the traditional gypsy and traveller workers
in
this country.
Listen, the modern agribusiness, it's much bigger than it used to be. I mean, it's quite clear that they need all these workers. And basically, British people, if they're on benefits, for example, they can't do seasonal work because they lose their benefits.
What do you make of this whole idea of just getting rid of this lifestyle completely that's been there since time
immemorial? No, but listen, I've just said to you, in the US they've got all these laws against trespass and all the rest of it, but they've got tent cities. That's economics. Yeah, we've not built any council houses in this properly in this for a generation.
Okay, finally, a little thing on Stormont, because they're back again, they're talking. I wonder, it's pretty obvious, Martin, isn't it, that this is all about Brexit. Now, Brexit seems to be being sorted out. They're going to allow the Irish Parliament back again. It was nothing to do with anything other than Westminster is going to decide this and you're not going to have a say at all.
Well, in actual fact, if you look at the election in December the 12th in Northern Ireland, pro-EU parties overwhelmingly won. The Alliance Party did very, very well.
That could have been a problem, couldn't it? Well, it wasn't discussed.
Well, what's going to happen, of course, as long as Boris sticks to his deal, is they're going to be staying in the single market. And, of course, if I was Nicola Sturgeon, I'd be saying we want the same deal as the Irish have got, which means a border at Carlisle. And ultimately, of course, a border on the Severn Bridge.
But it's not going to happen, is it?
Oh, it is. It is, Tony. Things change very, very fast in the modern era.
Okay, thanks to our guests. That's Labour Councillor for Ashley, Mike Davis. Join us after the US-owned Comcast news at 7 as we take our weekly look around the world. I'd like to wish you good luck in the election, Mike, but you're not going to be standing, which is a pity. So anyway, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.